Joshua 2, beginning at the first verse and going down through verse 18. And Joshua the son of Nun sent two men secretly from Shittim as spies, saying, "Go view the land, especially Jericho." And they went and came into the house of a prostitute, whose name was Rahab, and lodged there. And it was told to the king of Jericho, "Behold, men of Israel have come here tonight to search out the land." Then the king of Jericho sent to Rahab, saying, "Bring out the men who have come to you, who entered your house, for they have come to search out all the land." But the woman had taken the two men and hidden them. And she said, "True, the men came to me, but I did not know where they were from. And when the gate was about to be closed at dark, the men went out. I do not know where the men went. Pursue them quickly, for you will overtake them." But she had brought them up to the roof and hid them with the stalks of flax that she had laid in order on the roof. So the men pursued after them on the way to the Jordan as far as the fords. And the gate was shut as soon as the pursuers had gone out. Before the men lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to the men, "I know the Lord has given you the land and that the fear of you has fallen upon us, so that all the inhabitants of the land melt away before you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and Og, whom you devoted to destruction. And as soon as we heard it, our hearts melted, and there was no spirit left in any man because of you. For the Lord your God, He is God in the heavens above and on the earth beneath. Now then, please swear to me by the Lord that as I have dealt kindly with you, you also will deal kindly with my father's house, and give me a sure sign that you will save alive my father and mother, my brothers and sisters, and all who belong to them, and deliver our lives from death." And the men said to her, "Our life for yours, even to death. If you do not tell this business of ours, then when the Lord gives us the land, we will deal kindly and faithfully with you." Then she let them down by a rope through the window, for her house was built into the city wall, so that she lived in the wall. And she said to them, "Go into the hills, or the pursuers will encounter you, and hide there 3 days until the pursuers have returned. Then afterward, you may go on your way." The men said to her, "We will be guiltless with respect to this oath of yours that you have made us swear. Behold, when we come into the land, you shall tie this scarlet cord in the window through which you let us down, and you shall gather into your house your father and your mother, your brothers, and all your father's household." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Please be seated. Pray with me for just a moment. Lord, in the moments we have, would you bring this famous story to life? May we hear again of this woman and understand your dealings with her, and how you conspired to move many men and many situations for her good. May we see ourselves in her. May we understand ourselves as like her, and may we reach out for the hand of your mercy as she does here. We pray in the name of the one who gives that mercy, even Jesus Christ. Amen. Time is short, so I'm going to directly move to helping you understand the organization of this passage. There are two main things that will help you understand what is indeed a familiar story, but a story that sometimes we focus on incorrectly. Two things: the suspense of the story's focus, and the surety of Rahab's faith. First, the suspense of the story's focus. One of the great things about the writers of the narratives of the Bible is that they love suspense. They do a good job with suspense stories. They enjoy bringing us up to the edge sometimes and then leaving us right there for a while in order to whet our appetites for what the real answer or the solution to a particular dilemma or situation may be. This is what happens here in Joshua chapter 2. Joshua sends two spies into Jericho. Remember now, the city is a huge walled city, completely shut up to outsiders. No Israelite alive had ever seen anything like it. Remember, they are just on the other side of the Jordan, looking up at this huge walled mammoth city. They had been in the desert for 40 years. They had seen no cities in the desert. Perhaps their parents and grandparents would tell them stories about the old cities of Egypt, the grand and glorious cities there of Ramses and Katunah and cities like that. But no Israelite had ever seen the likes of Jericho. The issue, you see, was not just that it was a fortified city, but that it was a city in the way. It was in the way to the people moving into the land to take the land which God had been promising them all through the first five books of the Bible, of course, but especially here as we have seen in Joshua chapter 1. It is a city in the way. In order to take the land, they must first take the city. Go and view the land and especially the city, Joshua tells the two appointed spies. Now, the city gate was probably the only way in or out, and it was purposely set up this way in order to control the flow of people and to keep unwanted enemies out. The gate is open during the daytime, so the citizens of Jericho can go in and out, presumably to cultivate the surrounding land for their needed crops. But the gate is shut at sunset. The spies sneak in, perhaps in the late afternoon rush hour of traffic, returning back into the city. But the security checkpoint is a good one. And in some way, we're not told exactly how, the presence of the spies in the city becomes known, and it is reported to the king of Jericho. The king apparently also learns that the spies have gone to Rahab's house, and he sends word for them to be brought to him. Now, Rahab lies, as we all know. Perhaps even to say it a little bit more precisely, she tells a half-truth. Men came here, she says, truthfully enough, but near to sunset, they left the city. Go chase them. They can't be that far away yet. And here is where the suspense comes in. The spies, we know, are hiding on Rahab's roof. But by now the sun has set, and the gates of the city have been closed. And so there is a suspense set up in verse 7, and it is, how are these spies going to get out safely? How are they going to make the escape from the city, which they must have if they are to get away? And the suspense is not relieved until verse 15. When Rahab lets the spies down through a window in her house by means of a rope, and the window, we learn there in verse 15 for the first time, is built into the wall of a city, much like the cities of Europe, say of Tuscany. Some of you have been there and seen the walled cities of the small towns between Rome and Florence, where people's homes are actually built into the wall of the city itself. The author purposely builds tension. And he does so purposely leaving us hanging in order that we will pay attention to the heart of the story, which comes in verses 8 through 14. So he leads us up to verse 7 and then hangs us right there as if he's calling to attention what is about ready to come. And then what comes is different than we expect. And he doesn't resolve the tension until we get back to verse 15. But before the author And we get to that most important part of the story in verses 8 through 14. There's one more thing about the focus of the story that you need to see. By putting the guts of the account and the meaning of it in the middle of the drama, and by actually changing the focus of the story in verse 8 to Rahab's conversation with the spies, the author is telling us what we should not worry about. We should not worry about Rahab's lie. If I had $100 for every time I've been in a discussion about whether Rahab's lie was justified, I could send my kids to college on the proceeds. And since I have recently joined the ranks that are suffering from maltuition, I would like that very much. Now look, was Rahab doing the right thing by fibbing to the Jericho Police Department? One wise writer says this: it's tragic when people snag their pants on the nail of Rahab's lie and never get around to hearing Rahab's truth. It's like watching a football game in which your home team wins by 30 points and then complaining because half of the game the left sock of the quarterback kept falling down. If you do that, you focus on the wrong thing. And the New Testament doesn't do that when it comes to Rahab. How does the New Testament speak of Rahab? Does it talk about her lie? Doesn't mention it. It talks about her faith. Hebrews 11, verse 33. By faith, Rahab the prostitute did not perish with those who were disobedient because she had given friendly welcome to the spies. Now, this doesn't mean that the Bible or the Lord approve of lying. The account, quite simply, doesn't approve or disapprove. It doesn't pay much attention to it at all. Remember this helpful principle of Bible interpretation. Don't build biblical absolutes out of the Bible's historical narratives. In other words, in the Bible, there are teachings that are very clear and direct. They're precepts. They're things we're taught, and there's very little question about whether or not the Lord means for us to know them. For example, he says, love one another. Or he says, tithe your income. Clear, direct commands from the Lord. But they're a different sort of literature than the literature of the historical narratives of the Bible, which are giving us accounts of what happened in Bible history. And what the Bible recommends or requires may be different than what it records in those accounts. The Bible, for example, records that Jacob had four wives, but it certainly doesn't recommend that us husbands go out and do the same. So, don't get hung up on the lie, but move to the heart of the matter, which is her faith. And that leads us to the surety of Rahab's faith. The story doesn't focus on the lie to protect the spies, but on the truth of her confession of faith, which is made in three ways in verses 8 through 14 that are the heart of the story, as I've suggested, and where we will find new hearts for our own living before the Lord. First, this: Rahab affirms in her faith, she affirms God's powerful deeds. Look again at verse 10. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan. She had heard about the wonderful things which the God of Israel had done. We don't know how she had heard this, but it does give us encouragement that she had. The fact that she had heard this is great encouragement to us to remember that God always has his ways of making his truth known to those he intends to hear it. Just as Vernon heard the truth that he was intended to hear because God conspired events in Lynn's life, in the phone number of a Catholic church, in the ability Lynn had to find Vernon in this large nursing home, All events conspired in order that his purpose would be accomplished, that Vernon would hear the gospel just hours before he stepped into glory. And it also shows us not only that the Lord will have his way of making his mighty deeds known, but it also shows us that faith is not built apart from facts. In other words, what we believe is based upon what we know to be true or are learning to be true about God and his deeds. The usual way that we come to faith is by learning about the Lord and his mighty works. You know the expression, love is blind? That expression is really not true. It's actually just the opposite. Love sees and likes what it sees. I fell in love with Barbara because I liked what I saw and because of the definite things that were a part of her character that expressed themselves in things she did. Faith is no more blind than love is. It is built on what we know of God. What he gets through to us almost always and usually by his word. And faith comes, therefore, by hearing the word of God, which recounts to us the mighty deeds of God, what he has done and what he will do. It's very interesting that we Christians keep reading the same book. Don't you think it's time for us to move on to another book? I mean, that's what my father told me when I was in seminary. Before he was a Christian, and I came home from seminary, my dad, tongue in cheek, looked at my Bible on the kitchen counter and said, "Are you still reading that same book?" And the answer we give is, yes, I'm still reading that same book because it is the repetition of that book's truths that I need to hear again and again and again in order to see who God is by seeing who his mighty, what his mighty works are. Okay, so Rahab affirms God's mighty acts. Secondly, she also asserts God's magnificent fame. She asserts God's magnificent fame. Look again at verse 11. This is Rahab speaking. "And as soon as we heard it, our hearts melted, and there was no spirit left in any man because of you. For the Lord your God," she says, "is a God in the heavens above and on the earth beneath." Rahab affirms that only Israel's Lord is the God of both heaven and earth. She was very familiar with a panoply of Canaanite gods and goddesses. And the Canaanite gods and goddesses would take up habitation in certain parts of the terrain, usually in the wilderness. So there would be a god of the river, and there would be a god of the lake, and there would be a god of the craggy wilderness, and a god of the caves. But their non-existence and their non-power is shown because, well, there's only one God who occupies all the space of heaven and earth. And it is the hearing of this God, Rahab reports, that causes the Canaanites' hearts to melt in fear. So apparently Rahab was not the only one who had heard of God. His fame had spread already. And where the fame of Yahweh is known, his name is either loved by those who believe in him or bitterly rejected by those who resist him. In the end, there is only two choices. He is either loved, and his name is loved. Loved for his mighty deeds, loved for his magnificent fame, or bitterly rejected for the very same reasons. And you know, I find no other way to explain why it is that people who make no claim to know the mighty deeds or the magnificent fame of this God curse him by using his name and the name of his son repeatedly, openly, and verbally. It is as if they cannot deny that he is the God of heaven and earth. Just as Rahab cannot, and by God's grace does not want to deny it in her case, people cannot deny the truth. In fact, the Apostle Paul says in Romans chapter 1 that it is the tendency of men and women apart from God to attempt to push down and hold down that truth, the truth of God's mighty deeds and his magnificent fame. But again and again, God will surprise even them by the way in which the truth of what he does and who he is bubbles up in their lives despite themselves. Well, Rahab affirms God's mighty acts, and she asserts God's magnificent fame. And finally, and most importantly, Rahab is assured of God's merciful grace. She is assured of God's merciful grace. You see, real faith never stops with the affirmation of God's powerful deeds or with the assertion of his unique person. Real faith goes on to be assured of his mercy. This is what Rahab does in verses 12 and 13. She says there, "Please swear to me by the Lord that as I've dealt kindly with you, you will deal kindly with my father's house." She goes on to say that you will deliver my family from death, that you will deliver us alive from death. She begs those she rightly perceives to be the representatives of the God of mighty acts and magnificent fame. She appeals to them and begs them, "Would you, as his representatives, display his mercy in my life and that of my family?" She is not content with just knowing about him, or even just barely knowing who he is. She must know his mercy and grace. You could say that she is desperately seeking Rahab. She is a woman desperate. She will not let them go. She will cling to them. She will hold to them until she is assured that they, as his representatives, will grant her mercy and grace. Oh, she's impressed with the Lord's deeds. She confirms her faith in his magnificent person, but she desperately seeks his mercy. Now, to appreciate how much the author here in Joshua makes of God's grace, it helps us to see that the entire account of Joshua chapter 2 really isn't needed for the logic of the storyline. You remember back in chapter 1, we spent several weeks there. We talked about the promise of God given. We talked about the land being a promise, the presence of God being the promise. We talked about the importance of our participation, the Israelites' participation in that promise by faith. We talked about the fight for faith, or the need to know that God provides for us what we need in the ongoing fight for faith to lay hold of the promises of God in Joshua 1. Then in chapter 3, the people lay hold of the promise of God. They cross the river and they begin to occupy the land. Chapter 2 really doesn't have to be there. But of course it is there, because God wants us to see that the whole thing, the promise, God's presence, our participation, his provision to us for the fight, all these converge in order to reach one Canaanite prostitute. God moves all of heaven and earth, of which he is God and Lord. He moves it all in order to reach one lost woman. Or to say it perhaps better, Joshua chapter 2 is about the amazing grace of the Lord, who is never content to let the covenant just be enjoyed by those who are already in it. If Rahab is desperately seeking Rahab, then God is a desperately seeking God. He is seeking those who do not know him. He is seeking all of those who are outside of the pale of His covenant grace. He pursues them one by one. He looks for them. He moves toward them. He conspires events to reach all the Rahabs and all the Vernons that He intends to reach. And what kind of people does He seek? We're talking about a prostitute here. This is not a sweet girl who grew up in a nice Christian home and a Presbyterian Sunday school. The word for prostitute in the Hebrew language is zonah. Sometimes the Canaanite temple prostitutes would be given a special name. They would be called kadishas. But as one writer puts it, the Bible does not make much of a distinction between a holy whore and a plain whore. Rahab is a trafficker in flesh, a peddler of sex. She's right up there with the porn stars and the smutty magazine publishers. But, says Joshua in chapter 6, verse 25, Rahab, the prostitute, Joshua saves alive. And she is alive in Israel to this day, he says. God delights to display His merciful grace on the worst of sinners. Now, we can't have that, says one of my commentators, tongue in cheek. The church, he says, is only for respectable middle-class folk. And we know, of course, that that's not true. It's like saying sick people don't belong in a hospital. Only doctors and nurses belong there. But sometimes, and I'm being specific and careful the way I put this, sometimes we attempt to be more moral than God because we determine who's in and who's out, who looks good enough, speaks well enough, says the right words enough, dresses the right way to be part of us. The beauty of God's grace is that it surprises us by who gets it. Matthew, when he writes his gospel, seems proud to include Rahab as the list of ancestors that he has there for Jesus in his opening chapter. It's a little bit like he's enjoying rubbing grace in our faces. Can you believe that I am including this unsavory member of Christ's family tree on my list? Can you believe that I'm putting Rahab on that list? Do you know who she was? Do you know that she is a great, 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 great grandmother of Jesus? Can you believe it? I would dare say there are members of your family tree that you would like not to be there. I know that's true in mine. I could list many. I'll just mention crazy Aunt Eva. This lady was so crazy that by the end of her life, she didn't know whether she was Jewish, Catholic, or Protestant. She would say weird things, call us up at weird times, seek to make a nuisance of herself. And there was countless ways that we wanted to get her out of our family tree. But there she was, stuck up there in that branch, right next to my grandma. You see, the real question is not what unsavory character is included in Jesus' ancestry, but what unsavory characters are included among His descendants. And I am looking at a room full of actual or potential unsavory characters who are included in the descendants of Jesus Christ. I am the one who is the unfaithful harlot in the face of God's loyal love to me. I am the one who has run around on Him. I've sought my pleasure in things that are not worthy of Him. I am the one who needs to be assured of the Lord's merciful grace, that He sought me when I was a sinner in that walled city that I had built, filled with all my own false pleasures. That he sought such a sinner as me? That he looked for me? That he sent spies to spy on my treachery? And he doesn't lock up the gates of the city and throw the key away as I deserve? That he rescues me by providing a way out, a rope out of a window? Now maybe the scarlet rope is indeed a symbol of the red blood of Christ. I don't know, and the commentators disagree. But on this we can all agree. There is no way out but the way God provides. The city is shut. If God does not provide a way out of Jericho for you, then you will be a Rahab forever. If God does not give you a rope made by his cross, if God does not provide for you a way to be free, if God does not rescue you from the city, the walled city of your own whoredom, then you will be trapped in that city forever. God must provide the way out. God has provided the way out. It is the way of his son. It is the way of the tree. It is the way of the cross. And it is the way of his shed blood there. And that is the only way. And through that window of escape, you must go. You see, the surety of your faith comes not when you recognize God as the doer of mighty deeds, and not simply when you recognize God for his magnificent fame, but the surety of your faith comes when you see that his mercy is extended to you today. Today. You say, Skip, I received his mercy years ago. I've grown up in a Christian church. I've been around God's people all my life. And I say to you, my dear friend, be careful, be careful. The name of the city in which you live is Jericho. And again, we must find the way of escape. The Christian life is not once racing out of that window. Oh, it is. To be sure, you must do it once. And if you have never done it here this morning, you must do it this morning, because there is no other way to escape. But again and again in our lives, we must cling to the rope that is Christ. We must find him to be the one who is sufficient. We must seek his mercy. His grace is the only way we will get out of the city and into the land of promise. What city are you a citizen of? Be careful. Because first you must say that you are a citizen of Jericho. And if you are honest, as I seek to be honest myself, you will have to admit that there are places in your heart which are shut up with walls, where you have excluded the Lord and where his light and life does not shine. And God is in the business of turning all the Jerichos of our world and our hearts into a new city, a beautiful city, a city come down from heaven, the new heavens and the new earth, when there will be no more crying and there will be no more pain and there will be no more heartache. But until that day comes, we are in a fight. And the fight is that I must go out the window again today. I must flee. I must escape. I must run for my life, and I must cling to Jesus as my life today. Believe in him. Trust him as the way out. But believe in him again and again. Trust in him as the way out of that particular way in which the Jericho of your heart is walling itself up against the glory of God today, where you are denying the very mighty deeds and the magnificent fame of this God that you can see. You're stuffing it down, like Paul says in Romans 1. You're holding it back. You're keeping it from coming out because you are afraid that this God may demand everything. And you know what? He will everything. For if he provides the way of escape and you go into the land of promise with him, then, oh, my dear friends, you must serve him there. For there is no other Lord and there is no other King save the one who died for you on Calvary's tree. And there, at that tree, in that promised land, outside of the walls of Jericho,
you will find him. Turn to him.